I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, June 1st. Every year in June, the Supreme Court hands down its biggest decisions of the year as its term ends at the end of the month. This year, we're watching a number of consequential cases that could be decided any day now. And with Trump appointee Amy Coney Barrett on the court instead of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, some of these cases could be decided differently than they would have been last June. There's one involving a Catholic charity that won't consider same-sex couples for foster parenting, whose rights take priority. There's another challenge to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, that could theoretically get the whole system, including your health insurance policy, if you have one, through the Obamacare exchanges, declared unconstitutional. There's a voting rights case that could make it harder for people to collect other voters' absentee ballots for them and could make it harder to prove that any state's voting law changes are racially discriminatory. And that, of course, is huge right now with the ways that Georgia and Texas and many other states are changing their voting laws. WNYC's legal editor Jamie Floyd joins us now, as she does every year at this time for a whole number of years in a row, to follow the end of term developments and help us make sense of it all. Hi, Jamie. Happy June.
Hello, Brian.
Before we get into the decisions we're expecting, how consequential has the Supreme Court term been already with decisions that have come down along the way since Justice Barrett was confirmed last fall?
Well, you know, Brian, as your question suggests, confirming Amy Coney Barrett to replace Justice Ginsburg really created a lopsided 6-3 imbalance, which is against the very idea that the Constitution and even civil rights laws passed by Congress are meant to advance justice and equality, a balance on the court. But more profoundly, the conservative movement is finally approaching a goal it has sought for decades, ever since I was in law school when it started, this radical reinterpretation of the Constitution that actually prohibits our elected representatives from passing laws to provide us social safety nets and protect us from untrammeled power of large corporations. So it's a different thinking. Now, to ask about a particular term, Brian, is a little bit like asking about a presidential administration right after it's ended. You really need some time to digest the term, as you do, say, Obama's administration. You need some time to really understand the depth and breadth. And we're not even finished with the term. We've got a bunch of cases. We've got, I count, 26 cases, wow, all of which were argued virtually because of the COVID-19 pandemic, that remain on the docket undecided. So too early to tell, but as you point out, Brian, a significant shift in the balance of the court.
So let's get into these cases about to be decided, at least the few that I singled out of those 26, and then I'll give you a chance to say which ones I should have included in this list. And also the new hot-button ones soon to be heard. Would you take the legally married same-sex couple rights versus religious liberty rights case first?
Sure. And I'm going to remind everyone that we are still broadcasting remotely. It's become the norm, so we have forgotten that that's what we're doing. But today, Brian, just as I came to the microphone, construction began right outside my window.
Oh, I don't hear anything.
You may hear it along the way, so I just want to flag it for our listeners. So, yes, the freedom of religion cases. Well, there are a couple of big ones on the docket this year, but as you point out, one involves LGBTQI rights versus religious freedom, religious rights. And so it's a big test of our culture wars, really, in this country. And I would call it a blockbuster case. It questions whether the city of Philadelphia can stop working with a Catholic charity that is declining to screen same-sex couples as foster parents. It's Fulton versus Philadelphia. And it's really one of the most closely watched cases this year because it does pit pit gay rights against the Constitution's protections of religious freedom. And it's really not a new fight, Brian, but the case was argued just days after Amy Coney Barrett joined the high court. So it gets back to the question you asked at the top. Mm-hmm. It gives conservatives another potential vote in favor of religious freedom. And there has been a recent and important line of cases bolstering a very strong undergirding of religious freedom in the country, supported most strongly by Samuel Alito. And so observers, including myself, see the outcome in this case as going toward the religious freedom. And I would predict that Alito will write the case. I'm really going out on a limb here. You know, I don't like to make predictions, but that's right. My prediction. We've seen recent emergency appeals to the court, which were shot down during COVID-19. You remember, Brian, limiting church attendance to slow the spread of the virus. So and some other religious freedom cases. So that's where I think they'll go on this one. I could be wrong, but it's a very interesting one that looks at religion in the context of our culture wars and the freedom of LGBTQ couples.
Let me get into the weeds on this one a little bit, because I think it really is interesting, and that a lot of our listeners, whether they have a personal stake in it or not, will find it really interesting and important. And I think this is really a case that asks, can a city government refuse to do foster care business with a religious charity that discriminates against married same-sex couples? So would it be different if it were a private non-governmental group that wanted to exclude the religious one? Because I think the central question is here, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the city of Philadelphia says, no, we're not working with you, Catholic Charities, on a foster care program, because you won't even consider same-sex couples to be foster parents. So in a way, it's whether the city can single out the religious foster care group because it singles out gay couples.
You're asking an excellent and first order question in constitutional jurisprudence. So it's always about governmental action, city, state, federal. And so that's the first question. Can the city do this? Because they're the governmental actor. The First Amendment is about religious freedom, is about suppression of that religious freedom by the governmental entity. So when my kids say to me, well, I have free speech, I say, no, you don't, because I'm your parent. You can only raise that claim when the government tramples on your free speech. There's another big free speech case in the court right now that involves a young woman who was a cheerleader. She posted some stuff on Snapchat and her public school punished her. It's a public school. So that's why it matters. If she went to a Catholic school or a yeshiva, her rights might be different.
Or a non-religious private school, any private school.
Exactly. Now, you still have free speech rights. It's not as if you don't, just because you're at a different kind of school. And there are reasons for that, Brian. You raise a very good question. Let's say this were a private entity, going back to the civil rights era when private entities wanted to discriminate against African-Americans. How was that stopped by the U.S. Supreme Court? They used something called the Commerce Clause, saying, well, you're still engaging as a government entity in a way because you're using things that travel through interstate commerce. This incredible reach to say, well, we're still going to say there's some state action here because you're engaged in interstate commerce. It's a very controversial theory. But here you don't need to go there because we've got the city of Philadelphia on one hand and Catholic Charities. What Catholic Charities is trying to get, Brian, is an exemption. They want an exemption. Think back on the exemptions requested by religious groups from the birth control requirements in Obamacare. Mm-hmm. Very similar, right? Mm-hmm. And there have been other exemptions requested that this court has allowed. We'll see if the court allows this exemption to this requirement requested of the city of Philadelphia.
And this one seems right up Justice Barrett's religious liberty alley.
Indeed.
On a question where Ruth Bader Ginsburg probably would have voted differently. So it's a stark reminder of the change in personnel. One more question on this case before we move on to the voting rights case. since same-sex marriage itself is constitutionally protected now, why can anyone legally discriminate against a legally married couple for anything at this point based on sexual orientation?
Right. It reminds you of the cake baker. Remember the wedding cake?
Sure.
Well, it's a very interesting... I said Alita would write this. Amy Coney Barrett might write it also. I'd say one of the two of them. Because you have the right to be married. But this is a question about foster care and whether or not Catholic Charities has the right to determine who will be a foster parent under their program. You can still be a foster parent under a different program in Philadelphia, just not Catholic Charities. So the question is whether or not Catholic Charities, as a religious organization, has the right, a religious entity, has a right to exercise its freedom of religion to choose which parents will participate in the program. And then the city of Philadelphia wants to protect the religious, freedoms of its LGBTQ citizens. So you have these competing rights, but you as a citizen in Philadelphia or anywhere in the United States now have the right to be married. So this doesn't affect your right to marry in Philadelphia. It's just Catholic Charity saying, well, you can be a foster parent, just not through our program.
All right, let's go on to the voting rights case. This is from Arizona, which some of our listeners who are really paying attention will know that it's one of the states, one of just two, that many Republicans voted to reject the electoral votes from on January 6th. Pennsylvania was the other one. And specifically, this case involves when other people can collect your absentee ballot or mail-in ballot and deliver it for you, a practice that opponents derisively call ballot harvesting. What's the legal question?
Right. I love the phrase ballot harvesting. It really just means allowing outside groups to pick up mail-in or absentee ballots from voters and deliver them to election officials. It's particularly helpful when you have elderly voters or voters who cannot, for other reasons, get to the polls. And of course, it increases voter turnout. And opponents slash Republicans say the practice invites fraud, though instances of fraud, Brian, are extraordinarily rare. It's hard to find evidence of fraud. Supporters of this practice say that it enfranchises low-income voters who may be busy working multiple jobs or, as I said, just can't get to the polls. Maybe there are access to transportation issues or even in some cases the mail. The postal service may not service some lower income areas as much as others. So the bigger issue in the case, Brian, though, is the Voting Rights Act. So we come back to that. There's a provision in the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and civil rights advocates are concerned that the court could use this case to undermine another provision of the act that allows people to bring claims against states for some election laws that have a discriminatory result. That's one of the issues raised in the case. When you go and look at the case, they list out a slew of issues, and they made sure to include this one to give the court an opportunity to review a provision of the act, another provision, one having been struck down in Shelby, a key one, and advocates prefer a much higher bar set by the court back in 1980. And so there's this provision floating around that the court may or may not choose to rule on. So the ballot harvesting question on the table. And I should point out, Brian, that as of late March, legislators have introduced 361 bills. Did you hear me? 361 to restrict voting provisions in 47 states. And that's according to the Brennan Center for Justice, which is a nonpartisan think tank looking at voting issues. And a lot of this based on former President Trump's baseless allegations of fraud asserted after the 2020 election.
Well, what is left of the Voting Rights Act for them to challenge? You mentioned the Shelby case from 2013, was it?
Yes. I believe it was. I may have said 15. You're correct. 2013.
No, you didn't say a year. I was just, guessing.
Oh, Obergefell was 15. Shelby was 13. So right. Good news, bad news, depending
Obergefell
on your perspective.
Was same-sex marriage.
Yes, correct.
So this Shelby case really weakened the Voting Rights Act. Remind us about Shelby. What did it take away, and what remains that the people who want to make it harder to collect ballots are challenging here?
Well, the Shelby case in 2013 struck down effectively the heart of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. It was Section 5, and it required prior federal approval of any changes to voting procedures in parts of the country that had a history of racial and other discrimination. And it was a very hotly contested case within the court amongst the justices, 5-4. It was Shelby County versus Eric Holder, then the attorney general. And it said that that the Section 2, which is permanent and applied nationwide, is not an issue in the case. Justice Roberts wrote that because he wrote the majority opinion. But then he struck down the important Section 5, which would require you to go to the federal government and request a change if you were a county that had a history of discrimination. That went away. And Justice Roberts said, well, we don't need that anymore. The times have changed. Things have, he didn't say racism had evaporated, but he said discriminatory practices and discriminatory results, intentional discrimination, and the things that that section was written to address, they're no longer what they were in 1965. And this, you know, this is what John Lewis had marched across the bridge, with Dr. King and so many others nearly died for, was beaten about the head and nearly died for, sure. And here it evaporated. I remember seeing the tears stream down his face, as the decision came down. The Arizona case, that we see now involves two kinds of voting restrictions. One requires election officials to discard the ballots that were quote unquote harvested, and the other would make it a crime, Brian, for campaign workers and activists to collect those ballots in the first place. So it's another stab at voting rights and the Voting Rights Act.
Cynthia in Morningside Heights has a question about the case we discussed first, the Philadelphia case involving whether Philly can stop doing business with Catholic Charities on the foster care program that the city has because Catholic Charities won't even consider gay married couples to be foster parents. Cynthia, you're on WNYC with our legal editor, Jamie Floyd. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you. I'm confused as to why this is referred to as a case of religious liberty. I keep saying religious liberty. There's nothing preventing the Catholic organization, as I understand it, from continuing to refuse to deal with gay foster parents within their own bailiwick, so to speak. But it seems to me they're trying to force a secular civic entity such as the city of Philadelphia to do business with them against civil law. And presumably there's taxpayer money involved also.
Yes.
So I don't see why it's a question of religious liberty to have them be able to say that secular civic institutions must do business under their specific religious code of beliefs.
Cynthia, well, could be a lawyer for
the
city.
She could. I don't really even hear a question. She's making a good argument in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, and she is precisely right, Cynthia. Taxpayer funding is at the heart of the case. The case, which was heard back in November, the argument was very much about the fact that these private agencies, including Catholic Charities, receive taxpayer funding to provide these government services, such as foster care, also things like food banks, homeless shelters, other services. And then the question is, can they, frankly, discriminate against a gay couple that wants to engage these services, be they LGBTQ or, Brian, going back to your implications earlier, Jewish, Muslim, Mormon, what if they wanted to discriminate against some other group while receiving, as Cynthia suggests, taxpayer funding? So that's the question. To me, if I were a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, the answer would clearly be no. You can do what you want to do, but you can't have our taxpayer funding under the Constitution. But I think the court may very well rule differently in this case, given the recent rulings on religious freedom. And they've carved out taxpayer support for religious education. They've sidestepped job discrimination laws, health insurance coverage for contraceptives, as I've mentioned. So I think they see it very differently, Cynthia.
All right. Thanks, Cynthia, for your call. Let's touch on Justice Stephen Breyer, 85 years old, appointed by President Clinton, usually votes with the liberal wing. He gave a speech at Harvard in April in which he seemed to warn President Biden and Democrats in Congress against expanding the Supreme Court to counter what they see as Mitch McConnell's dirty pool, refusing to consider a nominee near the end of Obama's term as president, but rushing through Justice Barrett at the end of Trump's. And in this minute and a half clip from Breyer's speech, he had just described some of the history that President Franklin Roosevelt made trying to pack the court with more justices in the 1930s. That was a long time ago, but
the court packing story is relevant here for another reason. Proposals have been recently made to increase the number of Supreme Court justices. I'm certain that others will discuss related political arguments. For example, will what goes around come around? Are the nomination and confirmation processes working well? Do appointments too closely reflect partisan political division? Has the court itself become politically partisan? This lecture reflects my own effort, however, to be certain that those who are going to debate these questions and related proposals also consider an important institutional point. Consider it. Namely, how would court packing reflect and affect the rule of law itself? Now, to discuss this institutional question, it's important to focus upon more than the rights or wrongs of individual cases, however important those cases are. When I or others dissent, naturally, I think the majority is wrong, and sometimes I think they're very wrong. But discussion of institutional change should include discussion of certain background matters, such as the trust that the court has gradually built, the long period of time needed to build that trust, the importance of that trust in a nation that values, indeed depends upon, a rule of law.
Justice Breyer at Harvard in April. Yes, justices of the Supreme Court do sometimes speak in public. And Jamie, we could obviously do a whole segment on this, but in our last minute, help us understand briefly what he's getting at. I think he's afraid, as institutions are breaking down in this country one by one, nobody will feel compelled to abide by even a Supreme Court decision if the court is seen to have been politicized by expanding it. Yes?
I think that's right. I mean, there are a couple things going on. Of course, he's 82, so he's under pressure, especially from progressives, to retire so that President Biden can name a replacement, while Democrats have this tenuous majority in the Senate. But and Brian, of course, when justices step down, they often do so at the very end of the term. So here we are. But he is one who is, as we've heard there, and he has a book out, by the way, decrying the politicization of the court. Mm-hmm. So that would seem to suggest he's not going to step down. And the book can be read. I've only read portions of it, I will admit. But the portions I've read actually are an indictment of the timed retirement as a political act. So that seems to say that he is not going to step down just to ensure that his seat is filled by a Democrat. It's kind of a manifesto, his book is, against the idea that courts should be perceived as political. He says, quote, if the public comes to see judges as merely politicians in robes, going on with this quote, its confidence in the courts and the rule of law itself will only decline. So I'm going to go out on a limb again, Brian, and say he's going to stay put. And then on the issue of packing the court or restructuring the court, also the other issue he's talked about quite a bit is getting rid of life terms for justices. A handful of Democratic lawmakers have introduced legislation that would add 4 seats to the Supreme Court. That landed with a thud in Congress. Nancy Pelosi said she has no plans to bring the bill to the floor. President Biden has a commission studying Supreme Court reform, but there are no really outspoken proponents of reform on the commission. So, you know, I think Justice Breyer, 82 though he may be, is pretty much, you know, sitting in a seat that will be reflected well in history. He's on the right side of history. And I think, you know, the court is a strong institution at a time when our other institutions, Congress and the executive branch, the presidency, are extremely weak. So I'm happy that the court, though conservatively balanced, is still mostly legitimate in the eyes of the public.
WNYC legal editor Jamie Floyd, who I suspect will have reason to join us once or twice, let's say, this month, as these big end-of-term Supreme Court decisions come down. Jamie, thanks for today.
Always my pleasure, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.